Hi, today is July 17th, 2022. I'm Todd Agasawara, my good friend, a good Dr. John Westfall. And this is Mobile Views Podcast 416. And once again, I'm not sure how much we have to talk about. We have a few things in the show notes, but they're kind of short. First thing I wanted to mention is Chrome OS Flex, which used to be called something else. I forget what, ever something, that Google bought, and it allows you to run Chrome OS on anything, PC, Mac, whatever. So now it has 295 certified devices that will guaranteed, or as we say in Hawaii, garan balbarans, guaranteed to run Chrome OS on those 295 devices, and a bunch of other devices where you go, it might run, and a few that goes, you could try. I still haven't tried it, John. And it's something you could try without buying stuff, because you've probably got lots of PCs lying around. And you tempted yet to try Chrome OS?
Not yet. I have such a bad taste in my mouth from Chrome, and it's from admittedly a very bad place, and that is I have students that have Chromebooks that can't run the software they need to run for my classes, and I have gotten this PTSD sort of reaction when a student emails me and this says the word Chromebook.
Oh boy.
Or I realize that they have a Chromebook, because then I'm going to have to tell them, sorry, it's not going to work, and then they're going to be mad because they just paid for this thing, and even though we told them not to, and it's in my syllabus, don't buy it. I hate that, because I like the idea of a Chromebook in theory, but in practice, I just don't think they're ready for every use scenario yet.
Yeah. So I think, okay, this is what I think, okay, because you're in a university setting, and this is not something you can do directly, but maybe you can encourage folks in the university you work at to do it. There are two possibilities. Both of them cost money, unfortunately. And I know in public universities, money is not something readily available all the time. Thing number one. There is Parallels for Chromebooks. I don't know how it works. I don't see how it can work on an ARM device. It might be like a remote virtual machine, like a cloud machine. I don't know, but I've read about it. So, or maybe it only works on Intel notebooks, Intel Chromebooks, which would be a non-starter. The other one, which I'm waiting for because I'm supposed to get access to it in August, is it's not new. It's going to be new to me, but it's Windows 365. Which is Microsoft, which is different from the Azure, it's all in Azure, but different from the virtual PC that, not virtual PC, what did they call it? Azure PC, whatever they call it, Azure Desktop. The difference is that the older cloud-based PCs that Microsoft has been selling were resource-based, so you get charged by CPU usage and memory usage, and basically, you don't have a fixed cost. So it's really tough for people with fixed income or fixed expenses like governments and universities to pay for it. But Windows 365 will have fixed monthly costs. So you have this configuration and you pay this much. And if you need more, you can actually reconfigure it. Like I'm doing a big project for the next, 30 days. I need twice as much RAM, twice as much this and, whatever. Two X processor power, and you can do it for a month, and then ramp down. Anyway, so something for the university to consider for students on a budget. Unfortunately, it probably raised your tuition, so that doesn't help.
Yeah,
but
it's and I sort of have the same thought about services like that, because I've brought up in the past that I used to have a dedicated computer at work, and now I've been carrying my laptop back and forth every day. And I go back and forth on that. And one of the things that I have is one of those Raspberry Pi 300 or 400.
400.
The built-in keyboard. And I have it at my office right now. And I've attempted to try to connect it to my work setup and then just use the Raspberry Pi for most of my daily things, because I could always connect to my MacBook over VNC, over my VPN, if I really needed something. But at the same point, will it just be more frustrating with latency than just carrying it every day? So I don't know. It's one of those things that I have up there, and I'm not using it at home, so I'm thinking about trying to set it up. But then again, I also found a very interesting thing. If anyone else is in the same boat that I am, where you're using a 10-year-old Apple Cinema Display, 27-inch Cinema Display through a USB-C hub, I plugged it into my iPad Pro a few weeks ago, and of course it works just fine. It'll display the iPad screen, but it changed the brightness settings on the monitor, and the only way to change them back was to plug in my MacBook and use the MacBook controls to change the brightness.
That's weird.
So another one of those annoying things about Apple not having any physical controls on their screens is because you have to be kind of at the mercy of their software communicating with their hardware.
Yeah. Well, you need to have a Mac to, you know, obviously, right? What else are you going to connect to it?
Well, I mean, 10 years ago when this monitor was built, or actually 12 years ago now, iPads had just come out.
Yeah.
They were completely brand new, so.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting, but talking about schools and requirements. when my daughter's first pass at grad school, the grad school, the program said, you just got to run Windows to run our software. Mm-hmm. They didn't really care where you ran it, as long as it was Windows. Mm-hmm. So I bought her a subscription to Parallels, and that worked out fine. Basically, it was for Excel macros and things like that, if I recall correctly, and some other, and maybe some vertical software. Then she took a break, and then she went back to, she returned to grad school last fall, so a year ago. And that one didn't say you had to, but, and even though we had Parallels on her MacBook Air, I think I bought her MacBook Air, even though we had Parallels on her MacBook Air that was, you know, still running fine, it would just not run this Java-based application, even though I installed Java and Windows on her Mac and all that kind of stuff. And so I ended up loaning her a Windows 10 notebook for the semester. And she returned it back because she doesn't like Windows. But, I ended up loaning her a Windows 10 laptop just for that one class, you know, so she, which could, you know, to run this Java thing that didn't run in Windows 10 on a MacBook. I still don't know why it didn't run. I tested it fine. I mean, I tested it for her. As in, you know, I brought it, you know, had her bring it over to my home, and I installed it, you know, by hand, not remotely, and tested it with other Java stuff and ran. So I still don't know what happened. But yeah, I guess academics are in academics, you have certain requirements, and some of those are tougher than others to fulfill.
Well, that's true, but it's also very arbitrary in terms of those sorts of things. I should also mention right now in academia, I'm experiencing one of these fun cloud issues because one of the largest textbook publishers, their online courseware platform is down this weekend.
Oh.
They went down for maintenance on Friday night. This is Pearson. And their related properties, and they have been down for about 48 hours now.
Wow.
Which is going to be frustrating, I suspect, a lot of students in the next couple of hours, because Sunday night at 11:59 tends to be a very popular time to make things due. I don't do it specifically because of issues like this. My next due dates are Tuesday morning at 11:59 a.m.
Yeah.
But... yeah, it's going to be a rough weekend. I wrote to my students and said, look, I have no worries about this at all because I know I can change due dates and change the assignments if I need to. I'm letting you know not to worry because I will do that if I have to.
Yeah.
But they, I'm sure there are actually a lot of professors that feel very hamstrung by these sorts of things because they're not able to roll with the punches. So.
Ugh.
It might be a frustrating weekend, and I can kind of tell from Pearson's system status dashboard that they are well aware that people are starting to get angry with them because their updates have gone from being, oh, we'll get back to you within a couple hours, to we know you're frustrated, we know things are messed up.
Could you turn off the flames on your torches outside of our headquarters, please?
I suspect that is definitely the sentiment that they're having right now.
Because, and if you could point your pitchforks downwards, that would be much safer. Thank you.
Because I'll give you an example. The updates yesterday said, investigating a technical issue that may be impacting your product has been confirmed. We are when attempting to log in, some customers may experience various errors. We will update you in 3 hours.
Wow.
Then last night it became, we apologize that maintenance on some of our higher ed services is taking longer than expected. We identified an issue where users may be experiencing errors. Our team is still working. They're basically getting getting more and more verbose as people are getting more and more angry with them.
Well, you know, a semi-related outage is Microsoft's Outlook for on the web for Office 365 users, which has been essentially not down, but less than fully functional since April. And this is July. And every time I look at the status portals, like, you know, you've been kind of down since April, right? Down is not the right word. You've been less than fully functional since April. And it would be really, really, really nice because a lot of people actually do use it in enterprise.
But,
All righty. Now, the next one. I'm kind of curious about your thoughts because you have to go in, I guess, at least sometimes.
Most of the time. Most of the time on Fridays, yes.
So, let's see. Who is this? It said MSN, but I think it was actually the Washington Post. Is that right? Let me go look. I went to Bing. I use Bing for news. But anyway, I like it. It's Washington Post. Has a shocking, shocking headline. Nobody wants to be in the office on Fridays. And John?
Shocking.
Shocking.
I can't imagine why. So I think there's a realization going on that this has always been true, but I think there's a realization going on that white collar workplaces 9 to 5 was an arbitrary thing.
Mm-hmm.
5 days a week, 9 to 5. This was not ever decided by science. This was not ever decided by studies. This was not ever decided by anyone other than we think this is how much people should be working, because prior to this, they should be working all the time.
Yes.
You know, the 5 day work week was a shocking concession that we should have 2 days off. So it's not surprising that now, as most jobs have morphed from what you are producing to what you are thinking and creating, in a sense, and your thoughts are the product these days, put onto, you know, stupid reports and other things that you have to put together. I think we're starting to see people say, why can't I have those thoughts anywhere I'd like? Why do I have to be in an office?
Yeah. So I've had people say that to me out loud.
Yeah. I don't think the full solution is that we go completely remote, as some have wanted to go. I do think there's a time and a place for collaboration in person. But I certainly think we should be open to this idea that 5 days a week in person is maybe not the optimal amount. Maybe it is 4 or 3. Maybe it's half days. Maybe it's team dependent. But we got to stop thinking that there's something special and magical about 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. Like somehow that is the optimal human performance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Metric.
I agree. I've always thought that, you know, even before the pandemic, I was a big proponent of telework, and I still am. Although, like you, I also believe that there's literally a time and place to be physically in physical proximity, but not too close, for collaboration and brainstorming and other things. Where, you know, like this, John. I think you and I have developed a remote rapport over the years. But it takes a long time to develop that. And you don't always have the luxury of that time for more than two people to develop a remote rapport. And so I really agree with it. And it's a very short article. Let me see. Continue. Yeah, it's not too long. And it's got a bunch of photos and some funny drawings and a little graph of Fridays are the emptiest days in the office and, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's really quite interesting. I've given people the option. I have everybody teleworking who can right now, because I'm still not comfortable with our localized virus spread. But I have a number that people know that once we hit that 7 day average, that we're gonna, you know, at least consider coming back to the office 1 day a week. And they come back generally in teams and not all on the same day. Like not everybody comes in on a Wednesday or something, and so we can still, you know, be kind of spread out. And that worked out last time before our numbers went really high again, and our numbers are going down again. So although the rest of the country appears to be not, but our numbers seem to be going down nicely. So I'm hoping to consider it again before I retire, or else the next person after me can decide what to do.
Well, and that's what I think my biggest frustration with work schedules has always been, is that people just don't consider. They, you know, like I said, it's almost like people think that there was a study done 100 years ago that said the optimal amount of time someone can work is 5 days a week, these hours. And, you know, if you even suggest less, then it's no. People need to be working that amount of time. There's science behind it, when in reality, there's none.
Well, you know, it's interesting because 35 years ago, when I was a contractor to the Navy, the facility I worked at had what was called a 9-4-5-9 schedule. Mm-hmm. And it meant every two calendar weeks, you worked 9 total days, 4 days 1 week with every other Friday off, and 5 days alternate week. Mm-hmm. And so you had every other Friday off, but you still had 80 hours because you worked 10-hour days for, oh God, I forget the math now, nine-hour days for, you know, a certain number of days until basically it added up to 80. And so you had a couple of long days and a couple of normal, 8-hour days, and it came out to 80 hours. So you still work 80 hours a week. You're just not working 5 days a week every week.
Yeah.
And people loved it. I loved it.
Yeah.
You know, every other week was a 3-day weekend for me.
Yeah. And that's, I think, one of those mindset models that if it works, it works well. And I would encourage managers to experiment with those things, especially, as you're thinking about bringing people back into offices and all of this telework.
Yeah.
Make it a conversation of let's try a few different schedules and see what happens versus, no, I'm going to pick a schedule. I also don't understand where managers get the mindset that they somehow divinely know these things off the top of their head.
Yeah.
They somehow, because I'm the manager, I know how the most optimal way to go is. No, you don't unless you've tried it.
Right. Or what you think you know is just basically belief. It's not based on actual,
Yes.
tested theories. But anyway. One of my favorite topics. Love telework. Loved it. I actually did a little bit of it even when we had that 4-5-9 schedule. I think every Thursday I worked half a morning at home just to get my stupid reports done. We had weekly reports. And so my boss and I said, and my reports are long because we had just a lot of tasks. And he says, yeah, just stay at home in the mornings on Thursday and finish it up and then drive in. So he was fine with that. And this is when I had a 300 baud modem, by the way. So this was, he'd write it locally and upload it. But at any rate, next up, something I didn't know existed. I saw a tweet about it. I think it was in a couple of places like The Verge that repeated the tweet that this person discovered. This Amazon has a recycling program that's free for small consumer electronics. Did you know this?
I did not know this.
Yeah. It says, if you think... Okay, so there are 3 steps. If you think if a device may have a trade-in value, please visit Amazon Trade-In. If your device does not have a trade-in value, go to step 2. In other words, you just want to get rid of it safely. And it says there's a recycling page. You can receive a free shipping label to mail in your small electronics to an Amazon-approved recycling partner. You print the label yourself, you mail us the thing, and you're done. How easy is that?
Sounds pretty good. I do like that when you go there, you can also enter the quantity of devices. So it's not just one time only. But, there are other things. I'm curious how willing they are to take some of these things. Because the quality devices they list are e-readers, tablets, streaming media, smart home. And then we get down to at the bottom. Other small electronics,
right? Which they don't define.
I might have a ton of those. Yeah. And I wonder if they take. They do have a thing for video game consoles and peripherals. I wonder if they take cables and adapters and other things that just we fill up these boxes with. Like I'm looking at right now, of just maybe I'll need that adapter one day.
Right.
That would be nice if they got rid of those things.
Right. And before people say, well, John, they only want things with batteries. That's not true because they have things like mice, which they can have a removable battery in a mouse. And so I guess you could just ship it without a battery. You probably have to ship it without a battery. And let's see, what else does it have? I guess the rest of them have batteries in them. But let me look. AWS devices. Now, that's sort of interesting. So I assume that's cloud devices, like appliances. Mm-hmm. That's not really small, I would think. But, like a 1U pizza box? Don't know. Video game consoles? That's not that small, But, I might try this. I mean, it's free. And they also have trade-in stuff, too.
Let's remember that we still use the term microcomputer to, mean anything other than a mainframe. So Small might be a very liberal definition.
Wait, John. Okay, you're kind of dating yourself here. When was the last time you heard somebody use the word microcomputer in a casual conversation? Not a historical one.
Not recently, but I do very much know that the computers that I think of in server racks are microcomputers, you know.
Yeah, that's true. So, for those of you, for the fives of you who are maybe too young to know what we're referring to, a microcomputer in the old days used to be maybe 20 pounds, maybe 30 pounds. They're micro, as John said, only in the sense that they're smaller than a mainframe.
If two people can carry it out to the building, I can still consider it a microcomputer.
Oh, boy. But
if you only need one rolling cart to help you, then, you know, you're on a microcomputer.
Yeah. So you can just go search for Amazon Recycling Program and you find it. I'll put the link in our show notes on the blog with this podcast so other people can find it. But I have some stuff I should probably just send in, you know, because I've just been keeping it because I'm a pack rat. Or it has a battery in it that I'm not sure how to get rid of safely. You know, if I crack it open or whatever. All right. Alrighty. Okay, next topic. I'm going to make up a word that's a terrible word, but subscriptionization. So I was telling John before we started a podcast recording that he's been reviewing or commenting on a lot of really interesting mostly iOS apps that have a monthly recurring cost or an annual recurring cost, a subscription, basically. And we didn't really see that on non-content apps. So, you know, we got used to paying for Netflix on a monthly basis. We got used to paying for Amazon Prime on a yearly basis. I think one of the first things I paid a subscription for might have been my Audible audiobooks, like over a decade ago, maybe, before the iPhone. But, you know, it's only recently that just sort of, and we pay for, you know, I finally got used to paying for Microsoft Office, which I resisted for years on an annual basis. But recently, a lot of the apps that John's been mentioning is not the one-time purchase that I got used to when the iPhone came out in 2007. Yeah, 2007. And it was a 99 cents per app for a lot of the apps. And it was like, sure, I'll pay 99 cents to something I'm not quite sure about. It's a one-time purchase and I'm good for it. And then the prices started going up. There are $2 apps and $5 apps and $20 apps. And now we're paying like some of the subscriptions, the high-end of subscriptions of some of the services, app services John's been recommending have been somewhere like $20 a month, if I recall correctly. Although a lot of them are tiered. So there's an article in Ars Technica that subscription iPhone apps finally made more money than games. And, you know, people have always been willing to pay for games. Mm-hmm. But it says, thanks to subscriptions, iPhone apps finally made more money than games. And I got to think about what that means and what the thing I've been noticing that, you know, John tries a lot of apps that have subscriptions with them. And what do you think, John?
Well, I was thinking about what makes a subscription justified in my mind versus not.
Yeah.
And I don't particularly buy the argument from app creators, the small app creators, I sort of buy this argument from, if it's their hobbyist project in a sense, mm-hmm. that when I pay a subscription, I'm paying for maintenance and ongoing updates. For a small developer, I might buy that argument, but I generally want to get something out of my recurring cost.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look through the list I keep on what subscriptions I keep and which ones I decided not to. And just giving some examples, you know, Day One, for example, is an app that I use that's for journaling. Mm-hmm. I do pay a subscription fee on that. It's $24 a year. The reason I figure I keep that is they do have a cloud infrastructure where they're backing up my data and keeping my data. So I can sort of justify that, although it'd be nice if I could just keep it all in the clouds I already pay for. But they do have some nice integration features, automation features, that sort of thing. Other similar things that I will be okay paying for, another one, like I said, as a small developer, okay, I can support you for $20 a year. The problem is when you get into some of these higher price points.
Yeah.
You know, and companies that maybe don't need the money. So I'm thinking of Duolingo and a few others where I do pay occasionally for a plus subscription, but in general their core offerings, they like to try to say that they're free or something along those lines. The ones that I cut out of my life, in a sense, were the ones that either had a definite purpose. So, for example, I was paying a subscription fee to MyFitnessPal when I was doing macro tracking. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing macro tracking anymore officially, so I cut that subscription so I wouldn't have to pay. And that was pricey. That was $80 a year just to have some of that functionality. Yeah. Cardiogram is an interesting one that I used to pay for, and then I realized that the data I was getting out of it, with the additional fee, I couldn't do anything with. There was nothing, you know, it wasn't like I was really getting much out of it. Another one that I tried recently, I forget the exact name of it because I never actually paid for it, so it didn't make my spreadsheet. But another one that I had tried was, you know, you got to see your biological versus your health age, you know, if you were aging more advanced than your physical years. Again, it was interesting, but what am I supposed to do with that knowledge?
Right, right.
You know, other than feel good or bad about my health.
Right.
And the other thing, the other item I had of note is that there are actively situations right now where I am grandfathered in to no subscription, but if they were to ungrandfather me, I would drop the product or I would not stay with the product. And the best example I can give of that is my Oura Ring that I purchased, the Generation 2 version, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. There was no subscription. When they announced Gen 3, they basically said, there's going to be a subscription, but don't worry, we're going to grandfather you in if you were a Gen 2 user. So right now, I still bought a third-gen Oura Ring. Of course, I bought it because they basically said, if you don't buy it by this date, we're not grandfathering you in. So it's a little bit of a hostage situation on that. But if they were to say, okay, with our next generation, our Gen 4, no one's getting grandfathered in, there is no way I am paying for, I'm buying a Gen 4. I will, you know, just sell the Gen 3 and never use the service again. So it's a dicey area, what you're willing to pay for, what you're not willing to pay for. And quite honestly, this is all contingent on Apple or Google not coming in and eating the lunch of the app manufacturer. So I think with Oura, their problem is now that the Apple Watch is going to basically, with Watch OS 9 this year, do all the same tracking that the Oura Ring does, and in many cases do it better. So what are they going to really argue? For a long time they argued, we do sleep tracking really well and we give you these readiness scores. Well, the sleep tracking Apple Watch is going to start doing at the same granular level, and the readiness scores, I don't know. I wake up every morning, my Oura tells me if I'm feeling good or not, and most of the time I already know that information. So unless it's telling me that my immune system is flaring up, like it has done every time I've gotten a COVID booster shot, so that's kind of cool to see that spike. But otherwise, I know if I'm feeling good or not every morning. I don't know about you, but I sort of know that sort of thing before it tells me, hey, you're having a good day or a bad day.
Interesting. You know, the one that personally kind of got me thinking, and this is a little while back, is I bought Notability, which is a really nice app. In fact, I liked it so much, I think I bought it for both macOS and for iOS, iPadOS. So I have two, you know, one-time purchases.
And I think I did the same for Notability.
Yeah, and I think last year, a Notability went to a subscription model. Now, if I had been using a free, you know, freeware, and they said, hey, you know, you've been using it for a while, you really need to pay for some of the features, I would have gone, But I paid for it already, twice, kind of. And so I was like, you know, I kind of didn't quite know what to do. And the pricing model was, you know, kind of like not, it was not too bad. I'm trying to look at what it costs. 19, is that a year? Let me see. Oh, it's not too bad. It's like $12 a year. So I was thinking, yeah, okay. I use it enough that, and I don't need the stickers and things like that. But I use it literally every day. I use it to just basically keep track of what I do every day. And so I thought, well, okay, maybe. And then they relented because I guess there was, you know, pitchforks and torches came out. And they said, you know what? If you bought it before this date, you're grandfathered in. Or grandparented in, to be, I guess, non-sexist. Yes. And And you don't have to pay the subscription fee. Although every now and then I get a message on my app that says, hey, you know, you want to pay a subscription. So I'm really not sure what's going on. But that said, I was, oh, and now I notice it's not updating my, it has not updated my, interesting, on my iPhone.
You know, I think about apps that got it right and apps that got it wrong. And you're sort of hitting on that with Notability, where the Torches and Pitchforks came out. Another app that's similar story for me was Drafts. Drafts, I really liked as an idea, the idea that everything goes in this one open text editor and then you dispatch it off to whatever it needs to go to. I wrote two books in Drafts, two of my books. I wrote Markdown and completely used Drafts for managing that. But I stopped paying for Drafts this last year because I realized I was never using 1/8 of the functionality of it. And I got sick and tired of paying for it on a yearly basis when I wasn't going to be fully utilizing it. Whereas if when I just paid for it as a one time, I was kind of okay with only utilizing 1/8 of it. But now I cut the subscription because I got annoyed I was paying and not using all of the features. Another app that I just flat out stopped using when it went to subscription was Fantastical. I used to use Fantastical on both macOS and iOS. And then when they said they're going subscription, I thought, I just can't understand a value add on a subscription for a calendar viewer. It's not like it's keeping my data. It's literally just showing me my data that's already in other clouds. I couldn't justify that. But the app that I think did it right, and I've mentioned this app before, is an app called Working Copy. It's a Git client that runs on iOS. So if you use Git repositories and you need to, you know, access them and see what's changed and do edits and merging and all those branching, all those things, you can use Working Copy for that. The way that that developer has done it is that when you make a one-time purchase with him, you get all the features that were in the app at that moment, and then I think you get a grace period of any features he's going to add or any updates he's going to do for the next 24 days or 12 weeks. I don't know. It's a good amount of time that he then gives you in. And then after that point, it starts telling you what new features he's added and what new updates he's made. And if you would like at any time, you can kind of fast forward, sort of just like a Git repository. You can update to the current feature set at a prorated price. And I'm sure this takes a little bit of coding behind the scenes for him to get it right. But I have purchased one or two of these catch-up subscriptions in a sense, where I will never lose access to the features that I had already paid for. But if I see a feature that I think, oh, that's a really nice feature, I can get the upgrade. Honestly, though, I think the last time I paid for the upgrade, there were no new features I wanted. I just wanted to support the developer. And I appreciated that this was the way he was monetizing. That wasn't a, hey, just give me a little bit of coin every couple of days or every couple of months or every couple of years, and I'll give you nebulous updates that I won't really be accountable to. It was literally, I'm giving you this. And I thought, okay, I will, even though I don't need that, I'll still pay for it because I appreciate your transparency. I appreciate the way that you're being very forthright about what you're giving me for what I'm giving you.
Yeah. By the way, going back to Drafts, wasn't the subscription kind of expensive too?
That one I think was $24 a year. It's the same one. That's not too bad. Okay. It wasn't too bad.
I thought it was like 50 or something. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the other weird thing with the pricing. I think a lot of people have realized that they can make more money with month to month versus a year. So you see some, you see things that I think are a little bit slimy in a sense, where it'll be, you know, $30 a year or $12 a month. And you go, okay, I get that you're banking off the fact that most people are going to go month to month because they are very impulsive and live in a nearsighted world. But it just seems like you know that they're going to do that. And you're giving me the $30 a year because you know that I'll go for that for some people. And for other people, you're basically saying, I'm not even going to give you a reasonable monthly fee because I want you for the whole year.
Right.
I don't know. That seems a little bit slimy in my my behavioral economics mindset. Okay, you know exactly what you're doing here. You're not offering really a monthly subscription. You're pushing people to a yearly. And if the yearly is reasonable, that's fine. But I'd like a reasonable monthly if you're going to offer it at all. Otherwise, just offer a yearly. And just say, right. Look, it's a yearly subscription. End of story.
Right, that makes sense. By the way, while we were talking, I fired up Notability on my MacBook Pro that I'm using. And I just noticed it hasn't synchronized since December 2020. And I don't get it.
Suspicious.
Yeah. So it doesn't want me to pay again. On the other hand, it popped out a note, which I did not screen cap, that tells me there's a new Universal app to download that is different from the, I guess, non-Universal app I'm having. I use, rather, on the MacBook Pro. So I'm going to download it since mine isn't syncing anyway. So I'm downloading that while we talk to my MacBook Pro that we're recording this on, and we'll see what happens. Because I kind of like Notability, you know? It's a pretty good app for what it does. It basically helps me, like I said, you know, keep all my notes in one place. Okay. Let's see now. And I think that's about all we have. I'm just trying to think of what other subscriptions I pay for. I mean, not much. I mean, it's like I said, it's all the kind of entertainment media stuff. So I pay for DC Universe, Comixology, you know, for comic books. I should probably drop one, especially as I get closer to retirement. And what else do I pay for? Well, you know, the various, way too many streaming video services. I do pay annual subscription for a VPN, which I'm not sure I really need anymore. Soon. That's about it. Speaking of subscriptions, I guess Netflix, which has been losing customers for the first time ever on the streaming side, although I guess nobody really thinks about their DVD side anymore. I read that they are going to have another tier where you have commercials. I guess it's a cheaper tier, but that has commercials in the stream. And I gotta say, you know, I pay for I pay for Netflix too, but I bought the Disney Plus, Hulu, ESPN package when Disney Plus first came out because it seemed like a good idea. And I've always been annoyed that Hulu shows me commercials, even though I pay a subscription for it. I think they want me to pay more. Disney doesn't have subscriptions yet, except little teasers at the beginning sometimes, but. Hulu has an in between, like real commercials, and they're always the same and really annoying. But anyhow, and as we spoke, I'm just trying to see if Notability is actually syncing as we speak, since I was complaining about. Oh! I see 2021 appearing now, so it is syncing, just really slowly.
Well, that makes us feel a little bit better about our grandparented in status.
Yeah. So it's up to November 2021 now. So I'm going to just leave it running in the background, and we'll get back to later. Anyway, as I was saying before I so rudely interrupted John, that's about it. And we managed to fill up over 30 minutes, 40 minutes now of recording. So once again, we have shown we can talk about nothing for about 40 minutes.
We're good at it.
We have perfected it. John, I think you may be out of pocket next weekend. Schedule correct?
Yeah, a couple of weeks I will be gone. So okay. I will see everyone beginning of August.
All righty. Well, that's not too far from now. All righty. Well, you be safe out there. How's the weather? Are you guys having a heat wave or storm wave?
Mississippi in July. So, yes, it's all above. This morning. Well, it's deceptively hot. I went out this morning for a walk, and it felt like it was the kind of walk that I would go out for in April or May.
Right.
And then I got home, and I was drenched in sweat, and I thought, how did this happen? Yeah. You know, well, there's that humidity thing much higher than usual, even though it still feels kind of okay. It's Mississippi.
Yeah, there you go. We're pretty humid in Hawaii too, although for whatever reason, our actual temperatures have not been as bad as they've been some summers this time of the year. So it's been reasonably comfortable, which I'm shocked to see. I don't know if because we still have fewer cars in the road or what the answer is, but it's, I'm pleasantly surprised. Anyway, I will see you when you get back, John. You take care. And this has been Mobley's Podcast 416.